Fred has provided several important information on related principles. Now that new to quantum theory can be formally derived from the corresponding to this string, information theoretic active matter system. So this research is in a historical context of, let's say, two movements in the foundations of quantum theory. The first one is the information theoretic approach, and here is certainly a limited list of names. One can sign Wheeler back to the 1970s, and then more recent work by the Valley, which I'm going to quote more, and then other people. And the main is the axiomatic approach to quantum theory, so a French philosopher of science, Jean Moore, studied at the end of the 1950s, that the modern physical theory manifests a certain tendency to look for an axiomatic representation on the model of axiomatic systems in mathematics. The essence of the axiomatic ideal taken from geometry is to define all the initial objects purely only by relations and in no way by substances or substantial qualities. So in these two lines, I'm trying to situate my own research. Here's an outline of the talk. There will be three parts. One, very short philosophical introduction, just to set out the scene. Then there will be a part about quantum logical derivation of quantum theory using information theoretic axiomatic system. And thirdly, there will be a part where the same information theoretic ideas will be applied to something different from quantum logical formulas to an algebraic formalism. So the same ideas will be used in two different formalisms of quantum theory. So starting with philosophy, in order to, from the very outset, to be the element of response to questions for the kind of information about what or where is your information physically, show me a physical system in which this information is contained. So here are four philosophical points and then a basic philosophical scheme in which I'm trying to do the formal derivation that will follow. So the first point is an epistemological attitude. I'm deliberately not speaking about ontological questions of the kind, is the information real, or are the particles real, or what is real in physics. So I'm concerned with theories, and I'm going to propose a theory, where a theory is to be viewed as a description of repeatable traits of the observed phenomena with the goal of predicting these traits in the unknown or yet unobserved phenomena. The second point quickly is universality. I'm taking for granted that there is no repeatable trait of any phenomena that cannot be described by some theory, like a theory. So this does not imply the existence of a theory of everything, because different traits can be described by different theories. Thirdly, I'm stating that these theories can be depicted and drawn in a certain form of a loop, where for each theory you say what is assumed and what is derived. So then an arrow will mean the direction of derivation from what is assumed to what is derived. And finally, to close this philosophical part, a fourth point, that if you draw this loop, then each theory will require a loop cut that will, in this loop form, separate what is assumed from what is granted. And another theory, of course, may operate in a different loop cut, so what is assumed in one theory can be explained, can be derived in another theory. This way, theories are in a way complementary to each other. So why I'm speaking about all these things? This is just in order to draw this diagram, these two loops. let's see how it applies to physics and information. Probably take a special thing. So let's see how this applies to physics and information. Here are the two elements, information and physics. We're going to loop, to cut the loop in one way or in another. So here is one loop cut. Information is assumed, it's a predisposition, and then a physical theory is drawn based on information. There is another possible loop cut for a different theory, where now a physical theory is going to be assumed. And the theory of information, so how information is stored, what's the physical support of information, etc., are going to be drawn from the basic physical theory assumed. Now, in this talk, I'm going to speak about this first theory, a theory which takes information as a primitive notion and derives quantum theory, physical theory, from this framework. I'm not going to speak about the other part, which is about information as a physical notion. So information is going to be a primitive or a fundamental notion, and now let's move closer to quantum logic. Before we start the derivation, we need to define the language in which this derivation is going to be held. So here are the three fundamental notions, three primitive notions, which are given in the theory, and one of them is information, just as I said. The first one is a notion of system, and the third one is a notion of factor or result of measurement, if you will, or an act of bringing about information. So the three fundamental notions, which just correspond to the loop cut in which information is a primitive notion, we need to use a mathematical formula in order to derive the result of physical theory. Now, in the second part, a mathematical formalism to be used is going to be one of quantum logic, and so each of the three fundamental notions is to be given a formal representation in the quantum logical formalism. So systems will be treated as physical systems. And then information is to be treated in this formalism as yes-no questions. So all possible yes-no questions that can be asked to the system correspond to all possible information, and then an answer to such a question is a fact. So if a yes or no, if one of the possible yes or no questions is asked, and then an answer is obtained, that's a fact or an act of bringing about information. So in this language, we are ready, at this point already, to formulate the first two basic axioms from which we will derive the formula of quantum theory. So here are the two basic information theoretic axioms. Axiom one, that there is a maximum amount of relevant information that can be extracted from a system. And axiom two, that it is always possible to acquire new information about a system. So these axioms correspond to the formulations in Rovelli's 1996 paper on the relational quantum mechanics, although you will see the formal development is very different from what Trevelli from that at what was taught in 1996. So the first question, yes, the first question, of course, to be honest, is about the word relevant. So the word relevance is, first of all, something which saves us from indirect contradiction. You see, the first axiom said that there is a maximum amount of information. The second axiom said that it is always possible to acquire new information. So why is there no direct contradiction between the two? Just because there is this word relevance, which of course will need to be formally interpreted, and we will need to give a formal definition of what is meant by relevant. So before moving to that, let's look at what we need to reconstruct in the theory. We need to obtain the Hilbert space, and hopefully prove that it is a quantum Hilbert space, not a classical one. We can still do classical theory in the Hilbert space. then we need to obtain the Born group and probabilities and the state space to go to that, and finally, dynamic, the dynamical aspect of the theory, evolution in time. So I'll focus on the first part, and then we'll speak briefly about the second and the third elements of the derivation. So for the field of space theories, the program of seven steps of reconstructing the Hilbert space of the theory. First, in the first step, we define the lattice of yes and no questions. As I said, yes and no questions correspond to possible information. Then there is a definition of orthogonal complement of this lattice. At the third step, there is a definition of relevance, the proof of both modularities of the first result of this lattice, that is both modular, which follows from the yes. Now, the fourth step is the introduction of the space structure, then certain levels on to be proven about this space, and finally, we discuss the numeric field underlying space and prove the final theorem showing that the space is a Hilbert space. So I'll focus on this number three, which is the definition of relevance and proof of fourth modularity. And then I'll speak about the final steps, showing which other assumptions are needed in order to complete the construction of the Hilbert space. Okay, so let's speak about this definition of relevance and proof of fourth modularity of the lattice. So what we have at this stage is a lattice which is orthocomplemented, which is complete in atomic two, and we need to prove that this lattice is orthomodular. Because orthomodular lattices are this kind of lattices one encounters in quantum theory. And here's something I'd like to speak about before moving to formal definitions. Just at the intuitive level, a motivation for what can be considered relevant information. Imagine that there are two questions, two yes-no questions, B and A, A and B, such that B entails, in the common language, B entails the negation of A. Now imagine that the observer asks the question A and obtains an answer to A. So there is a fact corresponding to an answer to A. And then this observer, for some reason, just ordinarily, asks a genuine new question B, not A. So usually such things happen if the question is really genuine, meaning that the answer has not been predetermined. So the observer will expect either a positive or a negative answer to B if he asks this question. Well, this in turn is only possible if information in A is no more relevant. Indeed, otherwise, if there had been an answer to B that would determine the answer to A. So the idea is that if someone asks a question which entails the negation of another question, then this other question and the answer to it have to be somehow forgotten, have to become irrelevant. That's, of course, intuitive, but that's what we're going to use for the formal definition of relevance. So we are going to say that by asking B, the observer renders A relevant, but of course, there is no, in the lattice, there is no implication here. And the negation is formulated differently, so we need to formalize this definition. And here's a definition of relevance. A question B is called irrelevant with respect to question A. If B joins the off complement of A, isn't equal to zero. Let me show this to you on a diagram. So here's B, and here is A. The fact that A is less than B for the moment, just don't pay attention to that. So any A and any B. Here's an orthogonal complement of A. Now, if there is such an element C, not equal to zero, that C at the same time is less than B and less than the complement of A. Then what happens when you first ask A and then ask B? So you first ask A and get an answer to A. Then you ask B. And at this intuitive level, as we should work on the previous slide, there is, so to say, some component of non-A component in quotation marks, component of non-A contained in B. So if you ask B, then the question and the answer that you've got to A becomes irrelevant, because there is something of non-A in B. So that's a motivation for this formal definition of relevance. Now this definition,
the lines mean something different.
We're going to look at that in a minute. Lines don't mean anything. Here the lines mean that, well, with C, okay, the lines mean that C is less or equal to B, and then the complement of A, but this line connecting A and B for the moment the lines and diagrams of this rich diagrams. The lines mean that the element lying below is less or equal to the element, because in the lattice there is a partial order. So the lines are just the relations of the partial order.
If there's the prime of less than the logical implication.
So in this case, in the lattice, it just means that you have a partial order.
So the
identity would be, and because the lattice is complete, you can take the joint of all elements. That will be the greatest element of the lattice, which is greater or equal than any other element. And you can also define zero in the same way. But these two elements, well, I'm just not to go too deeply the lattice theory. There are lattices where there is no identity and no zero, but in any lattice there is a partial order by definition. So the lines just mean partial order. So let's go back to.
Sense of your relevance and irrelevance. Mm-hmm. I would have thought the question is relevant, but another question is, if you know the answer to the first question and it's relevant, then that gives you some information, possibly not the answer to the second question, but at least some probable information, probabilistic information about it. Is your sense of relevance anything like that, or is it completely different use of the word?
It can be like this too, because the only case which this definition excludes, so when is a question irrelevant, is when by asking this new question after A, so you first ask A, then you ask B. And the answer to B, which you're about to get, can contain something which has been prohibited previously by A. So if you get an answer to A, and then you ask B, because there is a connection between B and the complement of A, so there is something which you want to learn at the second stage, at the moment T2, let's say, which you want to learn, which you're telling yourself, I don't know it yet. So even if you have known it before, you're forgetting that.
Well, I found a final part that the words relevant and irrelevant are used in probabilistic inference, Bayesian inference.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if your notes are going to be compatible with that, or is it completely different though? You don't have a probability structure yet.
No, I
don't have a probability structure. Yes. Is there right to say something of the form, you know, knowing the answer to B makes what you know about A irrelevant? So if doing a measurement of X makes what I knew about B irrelevant.
Yes.
That's the sense.
Yes.
Of
yes, that's the sense. Yeah. Yeah, except that we're getting to see that in the Hilbert lattices, this is really quite a trivial thing. So in the Hilbert lattices, one can show that this definition of relevance
reduces just to set theoretical conclusion. So in the Cuthbert lattices, if you have two questions, one is relevant, so if you have a question X, then a question Y, which is greater than X, then X is going to be relevant with respect to Y. And all other questions will be irrelevant with respect to Y. So in the Hilbert space, that's really something which is quite trivial. It reduces to the level of set theoretic inclusion relation and of complementation in the Hilbert space. But Hilbert lattices are something which we want to run, to obtain at the end. So the intuition, yes.
Just some clarification on the same point. So relevant in sort of relevant in a positive sense, because relevant here means relative in a positive sense. So if X is less than Y, then it means X implies Y. If you know X, then you know that Y is true.
Yeah.
But if you had something else that implied not Y, you had another X that implies the orthogonal complement of Y, then in ordinary language would be very relevant to Y also, because it would tell you the answer to whether or not Y was true. But here it's called irrelevant. So,
yeah,
to comment on the notation, or the terminology. Maybe that's what's confusing to people.
The connection here, yeah. What you're saying is that in the ordinary language, why, well, questions why and not why are related by negation.
Yes.
So then if X is relevant for Y, would be natural to say if X is relevant for non-Y, to for the complement of Y. Yeah, here it's different, because what the relation of relevance is connected with the sequence of answers. So if I'm saying X is relevant with respect to Y, that means you ask Y first. Then you get an answer to Y, and you ask X. So does that imply that you're going to forget your first result, forget your answer to Y? And yeah, relevance is a sort of contextual notion. So it implies that you know an answer. Then you ask this new question, and you look if you're getting to get the old answer.
So
best you're getting something new.
So X is the new question, and Y is the old question.
Yeah, always thinking about one question is relevant or irrelevant with respect to another one. That's when you ask the first, the second question, intuitively. Well, formally, it's just this. Intuitively, it's when you first ask A, and then you ask B. So just to understand.
It won't be reflexive, I guess, that if B is relevant to A, that doesn't mean that A is relevant to B.
No, sure. No. OK. In the Hilbert lattice, let's do that. It's a trivial relation, and of course we want to see it's not trivial in any other way. So here's a lattice in which it is non-trivial. So question B, and here the lines mean clearly that A is less or equal than B, as we need. Question B is greater than A. We've just seen that if B was greater than A in the Hilbert lattice, that would always mean in the Hilbert lattice that it's irrelevant. But here, B is relevant to respect to A, just because, you know, by definition, B, meeting the complement of A, equals zero, so that's all the lattice we have. So the raw lattices, and there are actually infinitely many lattices, because you can construct more and more examples like this, where this relation of relevance is not equivalent to something like set theoretic inclusion in both implementation, where it has a meaning different from just, you know, relations of the lattice of set theoretic inclusion. So the question now is, can we use this definition of relevance to derive both modularity? And for this, we first of all need to look back at the axiom 1, which says that there is a maximum amount of relevant information that can be extracted from the system,
And before going to the proof of modularity based on X and Y, we need to assume something about this notion of the amount of information. So here are two minimal assumptions about the amount of information. If in a sequence of questions that you're asking, relevance is not lost, so you're keeping all your old information, then the amount of information grows monotonously as new information comes in. So if you're not forgetting, just then your amount of information grows. And the second assumption about the lattice is that the lattice contains all possible yes-no questions, so all possible information. Then there are sufficiently many questions to this lattice as to bring about any a priori logic by the theory amount of information. So you can always find some question in this big lattice of possible questions that will bring about the amount of information needed and the logic by the theory. So with these two assumptions, let's look at the stages of proof of fourth modularity. Giving a schematic proof here. First, by x and y there exists a finite upper bound of the amount of relevant information, which we call m. Then take an arbitrary question a and select a question a tilde such that for sequence a tilde brings about m bits of relevant information. Then we prove that the complement of a meeting a tilde equals zero. So that's the first result. That's the first step in this proof of all the modularity. Yes. These are yes no, but they can be counted. So you can take atomic questions and then which are non-reducible, so to say, and then take joints of these questions. So very complex combinations of atomic questions. They're still yes no questions. The second lemming this proof has to do with the reformulation of fourth modularity. So an orthocomponential lattice is fourth modular if and only if A less or equal than B and the complement of A needs B equal to 0 implies that A is equal to B. So that's a lemma which has been known for 25 years at least, but I'm giving a new proof to this. Probably shorter than one finds in Kalman's books. Okay, so now the essential part, proof itself. The question B, which appears in this letter, in virtue of the definition of relevance, is relevant with respect to A. This is just the definition. Then I proved that the question A tilde from here is relevant with respect to B, which follows from this result. Then look at the sequence A, B, A tilde. Each time you preserve relevance. But if B is greater than A, then this sequence brings about strictly more than A in tilde. So there is a contradiction with the initial assumption. But that's it. That's a schematic proof. And then, of course, the results which have been mentioned here have to be shown forward.
Why is it strictly more?
No, that's it.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, if it's strictly more, if B is more than it, yeah, because we have assumed that if you preserve relevance, then if you ask more questions, you get more information.
I'm thinking about sort of a question that's equivalent to previous ones, so you just get the same information all over again. So you might not actually get more. That's probably.
But then A equals B. If that's the same question, then A equals B. That's what. So that's what we want to get. That's what we want to get. That's what we want to get here. A equals B, and the lattice is all modular.
I'm sorry about A and tilde. I mean, are these yes no questions?
Yeah, these are yes no, that's Matt's question. These are yes no questions from the lattice, but they can be complex. So you, it means that if you have atomic questions, you can take, you can put and or between the atomic question. So is, I don't know, is spin direction x equal to 1/2 and spin direction z equal to, you know, 0 or something else. So you can, from, the question is still atomic. It's still a yes no question, I'm sorry. The question, the big question is still a yes no question. It's not atomic anymore. It's a complex question. But it's still in the lattice.
There's still in trouble seeing how you're going to get more than 2 bits on 2 yes-no questions.
Bits, okay, the bits of information that you can get from a question are a contextual notion. Because if you already know something, so you have your relevant information, then if you ask a new question, it is going to bring about some information. Maybe you're going to forget something which you haven't known before, because that's going to become irrelevant. So of course, the amount of information which you now have depends on this context and what you're being asked on previous steps on the video. But what we assumed in just before, what we assumed here is that if you don't forget, then the amount of information grows. So I'm not saying necessarily that one yes no question brings 1 bit of information. That's not correct.
But how's that?
It can bring a lot of imagination.
So when you have A and A tilde, are you imagining that you already had some information before A was asked? And that's why you can get all the way up.
No. But how can a question bring more than 1 bit? Imagine you just take something like a complete measurement. You can encode it in one question. So is you take a complete system of yes and questions, and then you put and between all of them.
Something like here, that said 1 equal half, and as said 2 equal half.
Yeah.
And the answer to that question is yes, except 2 bits of information.
Yeah.
That's what we got.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have a system in a living dimension n, and you take a complete measurement, and then you put and operators between all these things, then you're going to ask one yes no question and obtain the complete knowledge of the system.
So is you only obtain, I see this is like an answer to a question. So only if you get a certain answer, you get all this information.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So information has to be important. Okay. Now let's now look at the following steps of the derivation of the Hilbert space. Here I want to spend too much time on the talk on those things. I'm using complex theory, and there exists a finite dimensional analog of this. Here is an infinite dimensional version of the theorem. It derives the structure of the Hilbert space from certain assumptions. There is an atomic complete of module lattice such that field of which this lattice is the lattice of closed subspaces is built, so the space of which this lattice is the lattice of closed subspaces is built on a field which is a characteristic zero field, so lattice is a field of real or complex numbers of quaternions. So the complete of modular lattice we have, then there are two results which we still need to prove, showing that every finite-dimensional subspace of the space belongs to the lattice, and for every element of the lattice and for every finite-dimensional subspace of the space, the Lagrange sum belongs to the lattice, and then the space can be supplied to the mean product such that it gives a Hilbert space, which is lattice as a lattice of the closed subspaces.
When you say a linear sum, you mean the span?
Yeah. Okay. Lagrange span. So one question that I'm going to invoke here is this numeric fields problem. So we've justified fourth modularity of the lattice. We still don't know whether the vector space uses a characteristic zero field or is just an arbitrary space. So this has to be postulated, postulated.
Since you know you're assuming you have
that
space.
Yeah, I'm assuming there is a step in which I'm assuming an anthropomorphism between it's called step four, I think, and between my lattice and a lattice of n vector space. So any vector space. Which is quite a general thing. You can select not a sure vector space but any numeric field that repeats your lattice. Of course it's constrained, but just kind of a vague constraint. Now the question is, once you have this vector field, how to make the Hilbert space out of it? And one of the problems is that something has to be said about the numeric field. So either we postulate correctly, there's a substitute, an alternative for that, which is Soler's theorem. Soler's theorem gives the Hilbert space, without going into details, gives the best results. But it assumes something which is very closely in terms of the information theoretic approach in my mind. It assumes that in the lattice, there is an infinite orthonormal sequence of elements. So there is a sequence of elements such that each of them is a form of all others, and this sequence is infinite, which of course in the dimensional theoretic terms appears quite an implausible assumption. So instead of using Soler's theorem, we still postulate this axiom set about the numeric field. And then finally this is the theorem constructing the Hilbert space. Just to read the full formulation, let of your P be an ensemble of yes and no questions that can be asked to a physical system, and be a vector space for the real complex numbers or quaternions, such that the lattice of its subspaces is isomorphic to W. Then there exists an inner product F on V, such that V together with F for a Hilbert space. So this concludes construction of the Hilbert space. Now, I'll take 3 minutes probably to speak about two other elements of the construction of full formalism of quantum theory. Axiom 2, which you haven't yet spoken about, that it is always possible to acquire new information about the system. This axiom is used to show that the lattice which we have just obtained is not distributive. It's a quite simple result, showing that this WP, which appeared in the theorem, is a non-Boolean. Yes.
In the theorem you just stated, there was no assertion of uniqueness. Could there be many different inner products and equivalent inner products?
Yeah, there is no assertion of uniqueness. You construct one by hand and I don't know actually if all of them are going to be equivalent of isomorphism. In the infinite dimensional case, in the finite dimensional case, that's guaranteed. So in the theorem, you can show that in whichever way you construct this F, this inner product, all Fs are equivalent after multiplication by a positive constant. But in the infinite dimension, that may not be the case, but that's a good question, and then we answer for infinite dimensional things.
But in finite dimensions, it is.
In finite dimensional, that's a unique procedure after multiplication. This one?
So I'm just wondering,
sounded as if you already had all the subspaces as a lattice, and it seemed that you'd already therefore shown that it was not going at this stage. And in the next slide, you say,
the compound theorem is Compound theorem, what happens here is that you have your subspaces, your lattice, but you construct a Hilbert space. The question is, right now, in this Hilbert space, you can undo classical mechanics.
Sure. So the step on the next slide just follows from this theorem. So, right.
It uses these axioms too. The theorem, axiom two, is a common root of questions that have. Axiom two, if you will, is a common root of two things. First, this plus this. Then, when you're constructing this case, so your previous question, you just have a lattice. You want to construct a space such that the lattice of subspaces of the space will be isomorphic. So then you're also referring to axiom two construction procedures. But
you've already used axiom two before in one of your steps?
Yeah, just explaining it was the motivation why the price such thing exists. It was not really a construction, but it was an assumption that the state that the space exists, and an explanation for that. Refer to axiom two, but that's really an assumption. I don't know how to prove that the space exists. You still have to assume that a vector space exists such that it's isomorphic.
So that's assumed, not proven.
That's assumed. Okay, so that's this stage, let me show you. So this stage, the motivation, the step itself, so step four, consists of saying that there is a vector space such that the lattice of its closed subspaces is isomorphic to this lattice. That's, of course, on one hand, a big assumption because you move to the level of spaces. On the other hand, not such a big assumption because you just require it to be a vector space only without any structure in this vector space. But to motivate this fact, I'm referring to axiom two, saying so why are there so many things why do you need a space with such a rich structure of subspaces? Well, because there's something like axiom two which tells you that you can always move to new and new and new information.
So that assumption already gets the problem. Commentary on a lot of problems in all
No, but the very fact that you assume the existence of the state does not yet make the quantum theory, because you can still do this classically. Classical mechanics can be redone in Hilbert's case.
Then what are all those other? What if you take a set of subspaces that doesn't commute to those? Just sort of like say that you don't allow space states based on. And you can embed a lattice of classical questions.
If
you say a lattice is small, so it's not your.
Sure. Problem. Yeah, that's when you're referring to this axiom two, right? So in this step, when you're saying why the possible yes no questions correspond to all of subspaces, that's where you refer to the axiom two. Okay, so that's for the Hilbert space. Now for the state space, for the states and the Born rule, I'm using Wilson's theorem in this approach. You can arguably replace it with something else. The idea is to formulate the condition in the Wilson's theorem, so non-contextuality, in the information theoretic language. That will give one of the information theoretic axioms. So here's one formulation. If information I is obtained by an observer, then it is obtained independently of how the measurement was eventually selected. That means independently of information J about how information I has been obtained. So if you just have one fact, just one fact, this is a requirement of what I call no meta information. If there is one given act of brain about information, then you don't really know anything else apart from what the apart from the information that has been brought about in this one thing. So you can't have more information than you get in one thing. Well, this I won't really use on that because the formalism is the realm of Gleason's theory. So here's an interesting comment. What's a minimal set of assumptions necessary to introduce time evolution in this framework? And it happens so that you can introduce time evolution, so inter time evolution, just in virtue of one assumption, that time evolution communicates with formal implementation or with relatives. That means that if at the moment T1 you have a set of yes no questions indexed by T1, and then if there are no new facts or no new information brought about till T2, then what has been relevant for what here is preserved till the moment T2. So if no new information enters, your relationship of relevance is preserved between the questions. Now with this assumption, one simply uses Wigner's theorem and Stem's theorem to get a Hamiltonian description. And of course, here the unitary transformation is selected for the limit zero. And in Stem's theorem, one has to assume that this U is, I think, weakly continuous in T, something like this. So there's problems.
So that kind of theorem says that's the assumption that you want transformation to preserve the product. How can you reword what you said in terms of preserving the product?
The way you, what happens to the product here is that if this is true, then the way the unit product is constructed, it is preserved. So it goes well.
No, no, because the inner product has not a interpretation with the unit theory. It's a mathematical construct that we know about in Hilbert space. You know, the inner product has a relevance to all the transparent.
Yeah, that's in complex theory. Well, that's what I have shown in the talk. It can be constructed, the reconstruction in theory on the Hilbert space. There is this Kalmbach result used about how we construct this new product by hand. And this constructed based on formal interpretation in the lenses. So if this has to show, if time evolution commits with formal complementation, then if let's say inner product here was zero.
I don't know what you mean by that. Time evolution can be the or the complementation, or the complementation is part of the structure of your lattice. I thought we had the same lattice all the time.
No. Lattice is
different truth, obviously, but the same lattice.
Yeah, so here, when you want to get time evolution, you index yes and questions by the moment of time, which they're not. So there are sets or it's kind of each moment of time. Each moment of time there are questions that can be asked. Now the idea is to say that if at T1 in this set there was a certain relation of relevance. Now this set has to be that's an assumption all for isomorphic to this set that's preserving the relation. Then this is enough to show that if here an inner product was, let's say, zero between A and B, then an inner product here between the images going to be zero.
So I'm sort of using a Heisenberg picture of evolution when you map one of these things. What is WTMV? It's the question.
Yeah, that's a Heisenberg question. Yeah, so this U is basically
Yeah, so that makes it it's like a Heisenberg picture.
Yeah, that's like a Heisenberg picture. Yeah. So that's like you have operators. If you want, which you can, questions which you can ask are projectors in sense, or so they are operators.
I still don't understand what is WTFT. Are you assuming that there is a one parameter group of the yes no question?
Oh, it's that's an intention which okay. So W is a set of yes no questions.
Set of W for yes no
questions.
That's
P is the last.
Yeah, P is something I'm going to speak right now. I have to explain why it is. Just for the moment, W of P is a notation, which means lattice of yes no questions. Why is it W of P? I'm to explain. Here's where I'm going to explain. This information theoretic framework also allows to not to derive but to explain how one passes from projective description to the POVM description of measurement in this framework. So here's a sort of an explanation. The observer, because if you remember there has been this assumption of universality. So the observer is a physical system as A. So some other physical system can be getting information about the observer. On the other hand, the observer is what I call an informational agent. So the observer gets information. This primitive notion of information. Stores and knows what is relevant, what isn't relevant, so to say. This is of course not a physical distinction, but a sort of a functional distinction. You have a physical system which at the same time is this theory based on information, is viewed as an information language. Now the question is, can you use this functional distinction to eliminate the unwanted physical element. So here's the observer, which is an informational agent, physical system. Here's the physical system. So the observer interacts the physical system with this but we describe this process as asking yes no questions. So we can say, my observer, that's about asking yes no questions. Well, mathematically, if you write it down, so asking yes no questions to the self's physical system, then interacting with this physical system as according to the laws of interior evolution, etc. Something we want to factor out, not to be interested in, is this physical aspect. Well, in the information theoretic approach, we ask yes no questions about the system, and the fact that this also involves an interaction, etc., is not really something that we're interested in. So, in a way, one can say, want to see what the informational agent knows about the quantum system without thinking about the physical counterpart, etc. That the observer is also a physical system. So then, by a usual theorem, which Harris proved, I think Harris was one of the first proofs, if here I ask yes, any questions to P and P interacts with S, FP can be seen as an ancillary system, and the interaction, direct interaction between on and S is described by QA.
Yeah, then you have to assume that there's some kind of tensor structure between the local spaces and the S.
Yes. That's why, yeah, right. That's why I'm saying that's not the derivation. That's kind of, and other elements of the information theory approach, which can motivate. So the derivation stops at the previous stage where we derived the last element of what we wanted to derive. And here is an extra thing, sort of a motivation of how you can information or motivate. The use of QVM. Yeah, so
you also have to sort of dimensionality of the basis that needs to square the dimensional process.
You have to assume a lot of things to get this Harris theorem, tensor problem structure. But that seems to be an information theoretic explanation of how you test the QVM. So that's just a digression from the derivation program. Here's a summary of the derivation program. There are three dimension derivative axioms, which we have seen. Now, the information derivative axiom by themselves, unfortunately, is not fully sufficient to derive the structure. Quantum theory, so you need to add axioms to that. The first three axioms are really the axioms of what I call the conditional theorizing. That's an axiom that in the theory we're dealing with the lattice of yes no questions, that yes no questions have a form of lattice, and that the lattice is complete. So that's to say that we consider all possible information with a certain structure. Of course, in the real world, we never deal with all possible information. We only ask a limited number of questions. But the theory analyzes all possible questions that can be answered. So the mathematical object that we want to analyze this W, the set of all possible questions. And the passage to this set of all possible questions has to be axiomatized. So that these are the axioms 4 to 6 supplementary axioms, and then the axiom about the numeric field. So here is a structure of the symmetric system with information theoretic axioms and the supplementary. Now, if I had more time, well, I'd rather skip the algebraic parts and just give maybe one or two. Okay, here's a third part of the talk. So, in all the formulas where information theoretic ideas allow, it seems so, to make certain. Step forward. That's the algebraic formalism. Well, the first work on the information theory and the algebraic formalism is due to Clifton, Gulbeck, Halvorsen. Here's a different thing. I'm trying to show how one can give not a derivation but an interpretation. So that's purely interpreting the results. An information theoretic interpretation of certain results in the algebraic quantum theory. The first is an interpretation of the local algebra theory, and the second is an approach to time. So let me say just this. In the algebraic formalism, you of course change the formal representation of the terms. Now, the first thing which I can explain with axioms 1 and 2 is time finiteness. While without giving the whole story about time finite algebra, it suffices to know that time finite algebra of type 3.1 is what is considered to be the real algebra, the correct algebra, from Riemann algebra, of quantum. Physical theory, so quantum theory. So bit correct time of fundamental algebra is a type finite three type one or type three one algebra. And this is postulated. It just happens so that if you decode this type of algebra, then the results are correspond to the operations. So how finiteness here is interpreted indication theoretically as a balance between axioms 1 and 2, and what axioms 1 and 2 have to be reformulated, of course, in the new formal language of the algebra. So that's one thing. Now, there is a passage from the talk about finiteness to the idea of time. And this goes via something which is called AMS theory, AMS condition and cyclic theory, which shows how in a hyperfinite type 3-1 factor, Lerman factor, arises an internal notion of time. The work is due to Einhorn in the 1970s and then to Rebelli and Horn in the 1980s, in 1990s, the late 1980s, 1990s. So this passage from hyperfinite algebras to time allows basically to show formally, just look at this last paragraph, allows to show formally how the appearance of time in the algebraic framework can be interpreted as neglecting some information or treating some information as irrelevant. So internally in the type 3-1 Lyman algebra, there is a one-parent flow which drives this, which is called time and corresponds in the limits to conventional notion of time. And this one-parameter flow called time can be interpreted as arising due to neglected certain information. So that's
I don't know if this is a good time to comment on this, but my understanding is that the information you neglect is all the physically relevant information. It's all the local information. So when you have, it seems to me, if I understand right, this theorem refers to, say, an infinite thermodynamic system or possibly quantum field theory. That's the kind of thing that you have in mind when you talk about type 3-1 hyperfinite.
Yeah, that's
and typically in that situation, the inner automorphisms are the things generated by local observables. So all that's left is some sort of essentially irrelevant evolution at an infinity. It's not physical. It seems to me that in this you're throwing out all the relevant information.
No, well, that depends on what's the correlative information. So of course there is a state-dependent notion of time. Depending on the state where you preserve fully the local information of the local observer.
Yeah, but that's not
okay.
But then you have
a But then if you want a state-independent notion of time, so this I fully agree. If you don't want to throw away some local information, not affect out the local not affect out Lehmann for tomorrow's. Then you have a state-dependent notion of time, and well, here the interpretation stops. But then Horn and Rebelli say, okay, let's look at a state-independent notion of time. So we have to throw away something. What we throw away is going to be some information, but in order for this state-independent notion of time to arise, you throw it away. That's the way state-independent time arises. You throw away certain local information. Well, that's the end of the talk. So there are many open questions in the information theoretic derivation program. Just let me enumerate some connected to this framework. So there are questions of the information theoretic meaning of the supplementary axioms. then on the probability function, et cetera, et cetera. There is one interest, well, let's say questions 5 and 6 are purely and probably more interesting. How do super selection rules arise? Because we've constructed a Hilbert space such that all its quote subspaces correspond to yes no questions. So then if there is a super selection rule, some of those questions are going to be prohibited. Or is there a motivation for that? And then of course question 5, which is the favorite question of the first books, where does the dimension come from? This framework dimension was put in the hand when we said there is a space which is isomorphic. If there is motivation for the dimensionality of the space, is unclear. Okay, here is the quotation of Borges, which says pretty much the same as such.
Your first screening of your last question wouldn't give you any new information. You know, if you know exactly what the state is, then every other question gives you no new information, so your information gain can stop. So your axiom 2 says, but despite the fact that there's a limit, I can still gain more information. So what that tells you is that, well, you know, it's more like quantum mechanics, that you know, continue asking the questions even though these are objective measurements. And so it makes sense to me that axiom 1 and axiom 2 should allow you to derive the fact that you have an orthomodular lattice that's non-distributive, or clearly a non-Boolean algebra. But we have lots of examples of things like that, which are quantum mechanics. So if I take quantum mechanics and restrict myself to Gaussian states and Gaussian operation, that's an example. Another example is a certain set of toy theories that Gleason has worked on at Oxford and myself. And those sorts of theories are similar. They're also non-Boolean algebras. And so it seems to me what's key to showing you have quantum mechanics is not just to show that you have a non-Boolean algebra, but to show that it can be embedded in Boolean algebra, to show something like Fock's pilot theorem. And I don't see how axiom 1 and axiom 2 will ever get you there. So my question is there something I'm missing? Is that bit about the anti, there's the amorphous bit that I really don't understand, I understand this is the content, but does that actually get you to the fact that it's a non-Boolean algebra that can't be embedded in Boolean algebra? Or not?
What you can do, okay. So you're right. First you're right when you say that an orthomodular non-distributive lattice is not necessarily the lattice of the quantum mechanism. It's not necessarily a Hilbert lattice, but you need more things. The idea of how to get these more things is that because you have the maximum amount of relevant information, what you do is that you construct what I call fluid questions. So you construct questions, yes, no questions, which give you n bits of relevant information. They fully fill your stack of rules of relevant information. Then for these questions, you can define you can study the properties of those questions. And this is part of what Morelli back in his 1996 paper. So the idea of embedding this non-Boolean algebra in a larger Boolean algebra comes from the fact that if you study complete questions, then you construct structure of these complete questions, which is Google. So that's how you get Google embedding. But I haven't spoken about that.
But in this new block type, what you need to show for your content is that it can't be embedded in Google.
You were talking about pulling the Alfred data embedded in the quantum, you know, or the run, like just a sub class of a non-distributed thing. Whereas I think Rob wants to block embedding that whole non-distributed.
Oh, no. I want to do the other thing. No, I want to show that this is a non-Boolean algebra. We hope for each sub algebra is a Boolean.
Right, but what I'm asking is that what you need to show to show you really have quantum mechanics is to show not only that. It's not a Boolean algebra, but it can't be embedded in a Boolean algebra. This is where confidence method.
Sure, yeah, right. But fortunately, I'm just thinking, yeah.
Well, if you've shown it to Hilbert class, then you've done it.
Yeah,
the question would be, how did you get to Hilbert lattice? I mean, you must need something besides Axiom 1 and Axiom 2 to get to Hilbert
lattice. Yeah, right. There are those lemmas, and the lemmas are the things. The lemmas are proven via the. Okay. These are the things which get to Hilbert lattice. From. General legal quantum lens. So, how does one get these things? The idea is to construct three questions that correspond to, let's take finite dimensional subspace. And then, of course, this passage. Uses on one hand the idea of axiom 1 that there's enough problems but you can construct this particular question. And then it studies the properties of complete questions. So you assume things about complete questions, that you take the structure of complete questions corresponding to a subspace, you show why that is an element. Or here, this is more important. You take an element of lattice for an external and yes, kind of thing. And then you take a subspace. How do you show that you can add this subspace to the element of the lattice? You construct questions that correspond to this subspace. That's in machinery. You're right saying that there have to be more elements added. And there's also complete questions. So
the interesting is the assumption.
So the first axiom by itself, without any chance, is not giving you the open space.
And axiom 1 and 2 shouldn't give you the open space.
Axiom 1 and 2 does give you the Hilbert space unless you study complete questions. And yeah, so here, these lemmas, there's an underlined. Axiom 1 gives you basically this, if you have an off module lattice, and then of course you can have in the domain on one off module lattice.
Yeah,
well, sure, I'm available until the next weekend.
So maybe we should feed to just because of the miles. Yes, I will have to launch after.
Yeah, and then I'll get all this.
don't have so much tomorrow. Yes, it's not too much to have left. Well, no, it's okay. I'll take my office in the chat. Okay, back in time.